Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Today on Sound Effect, we bring you an investigative look into a spike in prison suicides here in Washington State. But before we get into the hour, a warning. This hour, we are going to be hearing about some people who died by suicide, as well as hearing from those who survived them. If you or some other listeners nearby are sensitive to these topics, come back in 1 hour. Washington's prison system recently experienced an increase in inmate suicides. During 2014 and 2015, 11 inmate deaths were ruled suicide, giving Washington one of the highest prison suicide rates in the country. There didn't seem to be a pattern, but the prison system knew it had a problem, but not right away. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins has spent the past year investigating, and today on Sound Effect, we present Suicide Behind Bars.
This is what it sounds like when there's a suicide in prison. You're hearing two-way radio traffic from the Washington Corrections Center on the morning of October 16th, 2014. An inmate named Nicholas White had been found hanging in his two-man cell. It was the 31-year-old's second time behind bars. There's an urgency in the voices of the prison staff, and there is tension.
I've got the security key. Go pick up medical staff, north end of the infirmary. Bring them to R2.
That morning had started out routinely. Surveillance video shows shirtless inmates playing basketball in a gym. You can hear the idle chatter of correctional officers in an office off the gym. They talk about how the microphone on the camera will burn them someday. You can actually hear them say that. Then White's cellmate stops by, and you can hear his voice in the videotape too.
I'm an A4. My cellmate's name is Nicholas White.
The cellmate tells a sergeant that White has been acting paranoid and talking about killing himself.
This morning, like with Vince, sorry, he's trying to tie a little sheet up there to see if he'll stay.
Cool. Okay. Have a good day.
Right. About 15 minutes elapses from when the cellmate alerts the staff to when the call for help goes out over the radio.
Take care of that. Go. Hey, that dude.
Even as the emergency response begins, everything else goes on as normal. The basketball game continues. The inmates in the gym have no idea one of their own is hanging in a nearby cell.
CPR in progress. CC base, CPR in progress.
WCC base receives CPR in progress, 1003.
At 10:20 a.m., a prison doctor declares White dead. In the office where the video is running,
his phone bell.
Someone in the office announces, the dude is dead. A handheld video from that day shows the ambulance crew leaving. White's body remains on the floor outside of his cell. A correctional officer walks up and places a white sheet over the body. Someone is heard saying, it's an unfortunate day. White was the fifth Washington prison inmate to die by suicide in 2014. In a normal year, two, maybe three inmates would take their own lives. This spike set off alarm bells within the Department of Corrections, but not immediately.
We started seeing an increase, and I would say at around the fourth suicide, we started to become concerned. It was different than previous years.
This is Dr. Carrie Rayner, who directs mental health services for the Washington Department of Corrections. Rayner says up until this point, she and her team had been viewing these suicides in isolation. Now, they started to look for patterns, for commonalities.
While we were looking at that, then of course we continued to have suicides that were completed, which just further raised our concerns, and we were taking a closer look.
After Nicholas White, there was one more suicide in 2014, and then in 2015, five more inmates took their own lives. If there was a pattern to these deaths, it wasn't easily detectable. The victims were housed in different prisons. They were different ages. They'd committed different crimes. Some were serving long sentences. Others were about to get out. Some had known mental health issues. Others weren't on anyone's radar. So who were these men? The first was Richard Billings Jr., age 38. He was found hanging in his cell at the Stafford Creek Correction Center near Aberdeen just after 3 one morning. Billings was serving a 12-year sentence for child molestation. He had a history of suicide attempts throughout his life. Just prior to his death, he'd been taken off suicide watch at the prison and moved to a single cell. His therapist later told investigators that Billings should not have been placed in a single cell given his suicidal tendencies. The next was Tony Willoughby, age 48. He hanged himself at the Airway Heights prison near Spokane in April. Willoughby was serving life without parole for murdering an 87-year-old woman. He'd been in prison for nearly 3 decades. The following month, in the same prison, Morgan Bluehorse, age 29, was discovered hanging by a sheet from the sprinkler head protection cage in his isolation cell. He was serving 15 years for a string of burglaries, and he too had a history of suicide attempts dating back to his childhood. In August, also at Airway Heights, Chance Kidder, age 19, hanged himself from the sprinkler head protection cage in his isolation cell. Kidder was nearing the end of his 14-month sentence for auto theft. Then it was Nicholas White at the Washington Correction Center, the inmate who was found shortly after his cellmate alerted staff. It turns out White had tried to get help. An investigation revealed that 3 days before his death, he had asked to see a mental health counselor. The next day, he submitted another request and said he wanted to get back on his medications ASAP. The day of his death, White had an appointment to see a counselor, but it appears no one let him know the appointment had been set up. The sixth and final suicide of that year was also at the Washington Correction Center. Keith Neal, age 43, was serving a 35-year sentence for multiple counts of child rape. The night before his death, Neal was honored by prison volunteers for his work as a teaching assistant in the education department at the prison.
It's R2. WCCB has received R2.
After each of these suicides, the Washington Department of Corrections conducted what's called a critical incident review. This is basically an investigation into what happened and whether policies were followed. The review includes timelines, interviews with staff, and it concludes with recommendations and lessons learned. But despite these reviews, the suicides didn't stop. The first 3 months of 2015 brought 3 more suicides. In January, Oscar Garcia Pacheco, age 34. In February, 23-year-old Nathan Bennett. In March, Jason Williams. He was 41. It was around this time that top staff at the Washington Department of Corrections decided they needed to ask for some help. That's when then-Corrections Secretary Bernie Werner picked up the phone and called Lindsay Hayes.
I've worked in the field of suicide prevention in correctional facilities for more than 35 years.
Hayes is with the Baltimore-based National Center on Institutions and Alternatives. He's viewed as one of the nation's preeminent experts on jail and prison suicide, and he agreed to come out to Washington.
So that was my task going forth, and I went out there and spent 4 days on site and went to 4 different prisons.
Washington has nearly 17,000 inmates housed in 12 different prisons, from Clallam Bay on the northwest coast to the state penitentiary at Walla Walla to the women's prison at Purdy. After his visit, Hayes wrote a 47-page report. We'll hear more about his findings later. But for now, consider this statistic found on page 4. During a 3-year period ending in June of 2015, Washington prisons had a suicide rate of nearly 24 deaths per 100,000 inmates. That is much higher than the average suicide rate in prisons, and nearly double the rate of suicide outside of prison. If you think about it, suicide should be less of a problem in prison because many of the means have already been removed. For instance, there's no access to guns, the leading method of suicide in the U.S. And yet, suicide is an ever-lurking danger in prisons. The inmates are locked up and deprived of social support systems. Many have an underlying mental health condition or have experienced childhood trauma, or both.
This is a global tell link collect call from an inmate at Monroe Correctional Complex.
Consider the case of Daniel J. Perez.
I'm 30 years old, and I'm at Monroe Correctional Complex Special Offenders Unit.
The Special Offender Unit is for inmates with serious mental health issues. Perez says his diagnosis is schizoaffective disorder and PTSD. He has a history of self-harm and suicide attempts. Perez first went to prison at age 18 for vehicular homicide. In prison, he says he became paranoid and violent. Less than a year into his sentence, he murdered his cellmate, strangled him to death. Perez spent the next nearly 3 years in solitary confinement, locked down 23 hours a day. He was getting mental health treatment during this time, but even so, he says the isolation took a toll.
And that's when my self-harm and suicidal ideations came back.
In 2009, Perez was moved out of isolation and into the Special Offender Unit at Monroe. But a few months later, he attempted to murder another fellow inmate. Once again, he was put back into solitary confinement, this time for 5 more years. 2 years into this stint in isolation, he attempted suicide.
So I ripped up a sheet, made a ligature, and wrapped it around my neck so tight that I lost consciousness.
Perez woke up in the hospital. He had been saved by prison staff who performed CPR on him for about 30 minutes. Perez says he attempted suicide because of the isolation.
The walls close in on you. They collapse on you. You feel detached. It's an overwhelming feeling of anxiety, depression, and paranoia.
Prison suicide expert Lindsay Hayes estimates that only 10, maybe 20% of prison inmates are in segregation at any given time. But he says they represent 30 to 40%, maybe more, of the suicides. In Washington, 4 of the inmates who completed suicide in 2014 and 2015 were in segregation at the time of their deaths, and at least 6 of the 11 had done time in segregation. While studies have shown that segregation can be psychologically damaging, it's also supposed to be physically safe. Chance Kidder, a 19-year-old inmate who hanged himself in a segregation cell at Airway Heights, wasn't safe.
We don't know what went on in that prison.
He struggled a lot mentally.
The fact that this kid had just gotten here and he was so young, and at least with the initial information we had, there was no predictors.
Coming up, we learn about one of the men who died by suicide while in prison in Washington State and the many missed warning signs. You're listening to a special episode of Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5 FM. Welcome back to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. Today, we're handing over our hour to Austin Jenkins for his investigation into a recent spike in suicides within Washington's prison system. We now return to suicide behind bars.
But I did give her the handprint.
In the kitchen of her two-story farmhouse, Jackie Lund brings out a large quilt.
Charlie, get this end of it so I can open it up.
Charlie is Jackie's husband. Together, they unfold and hold up the yellow and white quilt. At the top, there's an inscription in capital letters.
Can you read it?
Can you read it to me?
You're our hero, honoring the gift of life through organ and tissue donations. Charlie, you read that.
Chance was the Lund's longtime foster son. In 2014, he hanged himself in prison. He was 19. Before he was taken off of life support, Chance's organs helped save 3 lives.
We don't know what went on in that prison.
Chance was one of 11 men whose deaths were ruled suicide in Washington State prisons in 2014 and 2015. This is a video from the Airway Heights Correction Center near Spokane on the evening of August 18th, 2014. The sound is of Chance Kidder being wheeled to an ambulance. On the video, you can hear someone ask, "What's the status of the offender?" someone on the prison staff says he's breathing but unconscious. Chance had been found hanging in his isolation cell. One of the witnesses to Chance's suicide was a fellow inmate named Kazimir Volk.
And I'll just ask you to hold that receiver close to your mouth and...
From his cell, he could see across to Chance's cell. And that evening, he noticed something strange.
Well, I could see that he was tilted in a weird direction. Like, his head was tilted in a weird direction. So when I went laid down, because I'd lay down every 5 minutes or so and read my book, I laid on my bed and I tried to put my head in that position, and I couldn't. I didn't know what he was looking at. I didn't know what he was doing.
Volk says a few minutes later, a correctional officer came through to check on the inmates. More officers arrived, and they got Chance's cell door open. A Department of Corrections investigation into Chance's suicide praised the response from staff that night as exemplary. But it also found gaps leading up to his death. For instance, correctional officers were supposed to check on the inmates in solitary confinement every 30 minutes. But surveillance video showed it had been nearly an hour since an officer had last looked in on Chance. The report also noted that prison staff failed to follow up on information about Chance's previous self-harm behavior. And then there was this finding. The sprinkler head cage that Chance had used to tie his sheet to had been used in the last 3 suicide incidents at Airway Heights, and yet the covers had not been removed. For Chance's foster mom, Jackie Lunn, that's the unforgivable part.
I don't think that there should have been a way that he could hang himself in that cell.
Jackie and Charlie got the news of Chance's suicide in a late-night phone call at their home in Kittitas, a central Washington farming community.
The guy said he was a chaplain, and he was at Airway Heights, and it was about Chance. And I said, well, what about Chance? And he said he had committed suicide, and I just lost it. I can't talk about it.
There was someone else who was also devastated by the news of Chance's death.
I just dropped. My mom had to catch me.
This is Chance's girlfriend, Erica Littler, recalling the moment she heard Chance was dead. She told me the story of how she and Chance had met in high school. He was a year older, a football player and a wrestler. She was surprised when he asked her out.
He was the jock to me, so I actually... He was someone I'd never thought I'd really ever talk to.
Their first date was to see a horror movie, a period piece called The Woman in Black. They were the only 2 people in the theater. Soon, they were an item.
As I got to know him, I realized he was a really, really, really nice guy and cared a lot about people.
At school, Erica says Chance was popular, charming, a standout on the football team. Chance came off as a happy guy. But the more Erica got to know him, she got to see another side of him.
He struggled a lot mentally, and he had moments where he just felt like he wasn't good enough or he just didn't deserve what he had.
In the past, Chance had sometimes cut himself.
He would cut down his like rib cage, I believe it was. I know he did that once for sure.
Even so, Erica never thought of him as suicidal. Chance's early years were not easy. He lived with his mom and 2 younger brothers on the Yakima Indian Reservation. When Chance was about 5, his mom was paralyzed. The details of what happened are kind of murky, but we do know it involved diving into a creek on a hot summer day. Then only 2 years later, Chance's mom shot and killed her boyfriend in the kitchen of their home. According to a family member, Chance hid the gun from the cops under his mattress. After that, Child Protective Services got involved and placed Chance and his brothers with family members. When that didn't work, they ended up in foster care. When Chance was 10, he was separated from his brothers because of his behavior and sent to live with the Lunns.
Came with a sack of clothes, a grocery sack.
And a dirty, nasty sleeping bag.
And the clothes were either too little or too big that was in the sack.
The first thing Jackie did was get him some new clothes, and that created a new problem.
I'd yell, Chance, breakfast is ready, get down here. And he wouldn't come, and he wouldn't come, and he wouldn't come. And I'd go running upstairs, and he'd be standing there looking at his closet. He couldn't pick anything. He didn't know what to pick. He never had the choices of picking clothes.
Less than a year after Chance came to live with the Lunds, his mother died. It was an overdose. A family member says the death was ruled a suicide. After that, Chance stayed in the foster care system living with the Lunds. Because they were older, he called them Grandma and Grandpa.
And it was easier for him to tell people I'm living with my Grandma and Grandpa.
In high school, he got the nickname Forrest Gump for his speed on the football field. But off the field, Chance gave them trouble.
He was a little sneaky.
He was a hellion.
That was always one of his downfalls, lying and stealing.
First, it was petty theft, a neighbor's bike, a teacher's cell phone. He'd always return the item when caught, but the stealing didn't stop. Then came the day in 2012 when Charlie Lunn watched police car after police car race past his barber shop on Main Street. Soon his phone was ringing. It was a nurse at the local hospital.
And said that Chance has been hurt, so come to the hospital. And
Chance was a high school senior. He'd been found bleeding at school from a gunshot wound to the shoulder. He told the police a black man had shot him. That's not what happened. The truth was that he and Erica had had a fight after she caught him messaging another girl. Erica says she forgave him and thought they'd patch things up. Chance was still upset, and sometime that morning he left school. He walked a few blocks home, he broke into Charlie's gun case, and took a .22 caliber pistol. He then went out to the barn and shot himself. Erica says he later told her he was intending to kill himself,
but moved the gun at the last moment and got his other shoulder.
Crippled his right arm. It never did work right after that.
After being hospitalized, Chance was sent to an inpatient psychiatric facility in Bellingham. He spent 2 weeks there. Jackie said she talked to him twice a day.
He said, I don't want to be here. And I said, you've got to be there. You've got to stay there and do their tests. You've got to do what they tell you to do.
Chance was then sent to live in a youth home in Idaho for 4 months so he could get further mental health treatment. When he was released, he returned to the Lunds, but less than a month later, he turned 18 and aged out of foster care. So he got a rundown apartment in the next town over. But before his 19th birthday, he was in trouble again. While on probation for stealing an ATV, he and another man stole several cars from a used car lot. The judge sentenced him to 14 months in prison for theft of a vehicle. Once Chance got to prison, he, like every new arrival, had to go through a physical and mental health screening. On the written form, he disclosed his self-inflicted gunshot wound and the fact he'd gone to the Idaho Youth Home for treatment. But he denied being suicidal, and there's no evidence anyone followed up with him. Chance was designated a minimum security inmate with no mental health concerns. After a brief stint at the state penitentiary in Walla Walla, he caught a break. He was put on work release. He was then kicked out of work release, sent to county jail, and then to Airway Heights Prison to serve out the last 2 months of his sentence. Once there, he set up a prison email account and began writing Erica.
I don't want to lose you, and you know that I don't have much to say because you have it stressful. I love you and miss you. You're my everything too. Always and forever. Love, Chance, aka your sweetie.
But soon the tone of Chance's emails changed. He urged her to get a place of her own and to not always think of him first. Marriage would have to wait. His last message to her came August 6th, 2014.
I have a time limit. I know we work too hard together to be here and then give it up like that. I don't like it, but let me know. These are my thoughts and feelings.
A few days later, Chance got into a fight with another inmate. He had to get stitches for a busted lip. He lied to the prison staff and said it was a basketball injury. As punishment for the fight, Chance was put in segregation. 3 days later, he was dead.
I don't think he should have been in solitary confinement. I don't think he should have been able to hang himself.
After Chance Kidder's death, there was an investigation, and the report that followed offers several theories for why he might have taken his own life. Perhaps he was worried about being labeled a snitch for telling the truth about the fight. Or maybe another inmate in segregation goaded him into hanging himself. There were rumors to that effect. And there was something else. He'd been accused a few months earlier of raping a 16-year-old acquaintance before he went to prison. He said it was consensual, but she'd gone to the police. Perhaps he feared a new criminal charge. Ultimately, the report concludes that when Chance first arrived in prison, staff failed to thoroughly review his mental health history and should have asked more questions about his self-inflicted gunshot wound.
The report also called for the immediate removal of the sprinkler head cages in the segregation cells at Airway Heights, noting they'd been used in the last two suicides at the prison, as well as a recent attempt at suicide. But remember, Chance was the third suicide of 2014 at Airway Heights. The first suicide of 2014 was in April. Tony Lee Willoughby. He was found hanging from the bed in his two-man cell. Willoughby was nearly 30 years into a life without parole sentence for murdering an 87-year-old woman. The second suicide came the following month. Morgan Bluehorse, age 29, had just arrived at the prison 2 days before. He was found hanging 5 hours after he was placed in a solitary cell for his own protection. The third suicide happened in August. Chance Kidder. He was just 19. At the time, Maggie Miller Stout was the superintendent at Airway Heights. She's now retired. Miller Stout says in 40 years on the job, 3 completed suicides in 4 months in the same prison was almost unheard of.
It was sobering. It was, holy shit, what's next? How did we miss it? We're good at preventing this sort of thing. How did this happen?
It wasn't supposed to happen, especially at a prison like Airway Heights. It's a more modern facility designed for direct supervision. That means the staff spend their days in amongst the inmates. They get to know them, know their personalities, know when something's wrong. Miller Stout says the suicides shook her staff's confidence in their ability to recognize an inmate in trouble, to intervene before a suicide. The men who had died weren't even on the radar of the prison's mental health staff. Chief psychologist Lou Sowers recalls what was going through his mind at the time.
I'm scared. I'm wondering if we have a contagion issue. What are we missing? Should we be doing anything differently?
For Miller Stout, suicide was a personal issue.
My grandfather committed suicide when my father was 3 years old, and my best friend committed suicide in 1992. It's never been far from my mind.
Miller Stout and Sowers put their heads together, and they identified 3 categories of inmates that they felt deserved more attention. Recent arrivals at the prison, young inmates, and inmates new to segregation. In other words, inmates like Chance Kidder.
The fact that this kid had just gotten here, and he was so young, and at least with the initial information we had, there was no predictors. And that was one of the things that was quite mystifying, the self-inflicted gunshot to his chest. We didn't have any idea that that's what that was. He himself misled the staff.
Every time you arrive at a new prison, you get asked a set of questions about your physical health and your mental health, and specifically about suicide. When Chance arrived at Airway Heights, he denied past suicidal feelings or attempts. His official prison record listed his gunshot wound, but it read more like an accidental shooting than a suicide attempt. And no one had investigated it further.
And the fact that that information existed but wasn't available was real frustrating.
Had that information been available, Miller Stout says Chance would have gotten more attention when he arrived at Airway Heights.
He would have risen up the ladder to having more priority for services than he did.
The rash of suicides at Airway Heights and across the Washington Department of Corrections in 2014 and 2015 revealed gaps and shortcomings, and eventually led to system-wide policy changes. But those changes did not come quickly. Airway Heights Prison sits on a windswept plateau west of Spokane. It was built in the early 1990s, and the sprawling complex holds more than 2,000 minimum and medium security inmates. Last June, I visited the prison and took a tour. James Key is the current superintendent. He led me through a series of high-security doors to an isolated part of the prison even most inmates never see.
So, this is segregation.
Segregation is prison speak for solitary confinement. This is where you go if you get in trouble or if you need protection. It's where Chance Kidder and Morgan Bluehorse were when they hanged themselves. The inmates call this place the hole. But on first impression, segregation is bright and clean. It's got soaring ceilings to accommodate 2 tiers of stacked cells. Key led me across a tiled atrium to an empty cell where we waited for an officer in the control room to electronically open the door.
Come on in.
I stepped into cell number 4, and immediately I thought to myself, I could not spend 23 hours a day in here. It was cramped, 15 feet long by 6 feet wide. There was a built-in metal shelf along the back wall, a narrow cot with a very thin mattress. Just a couple of feet from the bed, there's a stainless steel sink and toilet combination unit. You get a bit of daylight filtered through 2 narrow windows, and you're in here basically all day long. It's not clear how long Chance had been hanging before he was discovered, but when officers did find him, they cut him down and immediately began CPR. They got a faint heartbeat back, and he was taken to the hospital. Chance died the following afternoon. When an inmate dies by suicide in prison, it takes a toll on the staff. Officer Zoltan Siglani has worked at Airway Heights for 20 years. He was on duty the day of another suicide, inmate Tony Willoughby.
When I arrived, we had already a unit officer and one of my co-worker responsive movement officers untying the noose that he had around the bed. He had a knot around the bed, and then he also had one around his neck.
And, Officer Siglani was one of the first to respond. He says when he got to the cell, two other officers had already cut Willoughby down. Siglani says they called for a hook knife. That's a special kind of tool that's kept in each of the prison's living units just for this situation. Picture a fish hook-shaped knife with serrated teeth. They're specifically designed to cut through sheets or other materials an inmate might use to hang themselves. There are 9 of these knives at Airway Heights.
To get your finger in there and work that in there, obviously you have gloves on, so you have a little bit of hindrance. And then, of course, to get that tool in there as well. So it was very difficult, not to mention the adrenaline that is going through your body.
Once he was able to cut the sheet, they began CPR.
The individual at the time was very pale in color. I could tell that rigor mortis had kind of set in.
Rigor mortis sets in after someone is dead. But even if there is rigor mortis, the policy in the prison is that officers must begin CPR.
The tightness of the skin, the clamminess, when you're actually performing the CPR, the breaking of the sternum, the movement of the air and what that sounds like, it's a wheezing sound. And all that you're taking in.
Correctional officers are not allowed to pronounce someone dead. And until someone is pronounced dead, they have to perform CPR. At another prison, officers had to do CPR on an inmate who died after slitting his arm and bleeding out overnight. The officers traded off performing chest compressions for about 15 minutes before an ambulance crew arrived, and that's when Willoughby was declared dead. The next day, Siglani was back at work. There was paperwork to fill out, there's a formal stress debriefing to sit through. And then it was back to the routine. But Siglani says he was changed.
The way I look at individuals and some baseline behaviors that I might question. I might just ask them, hey, how are things going? How's your day going? Stuff like that. So maybe just paying attention to some of those kind of things more so now than I have in the past, just because there was a life that was taken in front of me, and I think it always will change me.
Everyone I spoke with at Airway Heights said the suicides in 2014 changed them, made them more tense, more alert, more attuned to subtle changes in inmate behavior. After the suicides, officers started referring more inmates to mental health, and more inmates were self-referring. The mental health staff was already taxed. There were just 7 of them for 2,200 inmates. Superintendent James Key was the assistant superintendent of the prison at the time. He says after each suicide, there was just a growing sense of helplessness.
We're fixers, and we get it done. When you talk about the spike in the suicides, we want answers, and we're people who get answers, but none of the indicators showed anything.
But there was something they could have fixed at Airway Heights, but didn't, at least not right away. Picture a metal cage that covers the fire sprinkler head in the isolation cells.
This is what Chance Kidder and Morgan Bluehurst had used to hang themselves. The cage was there to protect the sprinkler head because inmates would break the sprinkler and flood their cells. But the diamond-shaped holes in the cages were just big enough to thread a strip of sheet through. Records obtained from the Washington Department of Corrections reveal that frontline staff at Airway Heights considered the cages a problem for years. But in the words of one officer, getting them replaced was like pulling teeth. After the death of Morgan Bluehorse, Maggie Miller Stout asked her staff to research an alternative, but the cages were still in place nearly 3 months later when Chance Kidder hanged himself, and it took another month after that before they were finally removed.
We wanted to replace it, but didn't feel a tremendous sense of urgency. It did reach that point, but not as soon as, in hindsight, I wish we had.
Miller Stout says her focus was on trying to identify which inmates were suicidal.
The fact of the matter is, if somebody really wants to kill themselves, they will succeed, guaranteed. So what we needed to do is try to figure out how to get men to decide that that wasn't a viable option, that there's other things, and give them hope in other ways.
She started counting the days and the weeks that passed with no suicides in her prison.
Please, let us get through 1 month. Let's get through 2 months. Are we still doing all the right checks? Are we doing all of the details right?
This is Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing, and you're listening to our special presentation of Suicide Behind Bars. In 2014 and 2015, Washington's prison system experienced a spike in suicides. 11 inmates died during those 2 years. In this final part of the hour, Austin Jenkins takes us inside the Department of Corrections as an outside expert is called in and the prison system begins to make changes.
It was March 2015 when a sense of crisis descended on the Washington Department of Corrections. By then, 8 prison inmates had died by suicide in 15 months. This wasn't normal. Washington prisons might experience 2, maybe 3 suicides in a year, but never this many. The Secretary of Corrections at the time was Bernie Warner. He picked up the phone and called one of the nation's leading experts on prison suicide.
Yes, I'm Lindsay Hayes. I'm with the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives.
Hayes has been working to prevent suicide in jails and prisons for 35 years. He has a story about when he first started in this field.
A sheriff called me up and said, you know, we had three suicides in our jail last month. How many can I expect? And my reaction was, Sheriff, you shouldn't expect any of them.
Today, he says suicide in prison is actually a fairly rare event. It happens more often in county jails. In fact, the prison suicide rate nationally isn't much higher than the rate in the free world.
With that said, however, there's this false sense of security in these facilities that because they happen infrequently, we sometimes take our foot off the gas pedal for good suicide prevention practices.
In June of 2015, Hayes flew to Washington State. By that point, there had been 12 suicides. Hayes wanted to see Washington's prison operations firsthand. He visited Airway Heights and 3 other prisons. He was armed with an 8-point checklist, and he later wrote a 47-page report that contained more than 20 recommendations. Suicide is a complex issue, and there wasn't going to be just one easy fix. Let's begin with what happens the day an inmate steps off the prison bus to begin serving time. In Washington, almost all male prison inmates start out at the Washington Corrections Center in Shelton. It's the reception facility for the state prison system. As part of the intake process, inmates undergo a mental health screening. When Hayes visited, he saw something that concerned him. The inmates were being asked these personal questions in a setting that wasn't completely private.
I always equate this problem to any of us in the free world walking into a doctor's appointment, and then the nurse comes out. The nurse doesn't come out and sit down and start asking us questions of a private and confidential nature.
In prison, it's questions like, have you ever been told that you have a mental health diagnosis? Have you ever tried to hurt or kill yourself? There's nothing wrong with these questions, but if they're not asked in private, inmates might not answer honestly. The Washington Department of Corrections says it's currently trying to figure out how to create a confidential space for these screenings. They have to figure out what will work and the cost.
The department is also working to do a better job of identifying inmates with mental health concerns. And if an inmate has mental health concerns, they now get a counselor and they're put on a treatment plan. This is new, but there are always challenges. There are only 140 mental health staffers for nearly 17,000 inmates.
It's very difficult to get psychiatrists into our services.
Dr. Carrie Rayner is the director of mental health for Washington Prisons.
We don't necessarily pay well as compared to other agencies, and we're particularly challenged there.
Another challenge that Hayes noted was that the key to any suicide prevention program is properly trained correctional staff. Even before Hayes arrived in Washington, the Department of Corrections was changing how it trains its staff in suicide prevention.
All right. Welcome everybody to DOC.
On a Friday afternoon last June, I sat in on a suicide prevention training session at the Department of Corrections headquarters near Olympia. There were about 50 staff members seated around a large conference room, and at the front of the room was a casually dressed, bearded man named Bart Applinalp.
Oftentimes people call me Dr. Bart. It's just easier.
Dr. Bart is the agency's chief psychologist for Western Washington.
If I can make it so that you feel less uncomfortable talking about suicide, I'll have done my job today.
Annual suicide training has long been a requirement for Department of Corrections staff, but they switched back from online training to in-person training after the increase in suicides. The reality, says Dr. Bart, is many inmates who attempt or complete suicide are not on the radar of the mental health staff in the prisons.
They don't have a mental illness. They don't have any diagnosable condition. You know, we had somebody just the other day who was breaking up with his wife on the phone and, you know, within 10 minutes was cutting on himself pretty severely. Not ever on our radar.
This is a recurring theme when you look at the inmates who died by suicide in 2014 and 2015 in Washington prisons. But look closer and some patterns start to emerge. Four of the suicides in 2014 and 2015 happened in special management housing. That's solitary confinement, or what the prison calls segregation. Hayes says there's a strong association between inmate suicide and segregation. After I went to the suicide training, I visited the segregation unit at Airway Heights Correctional Center near Spokane. Inmates here spend 23 hours a day locked down in their cells. I asked to speak to one of the inmates and was led to a cell door.
Hi there. I'm with Public Radio, Austin Jenkins, and I'm doing a series.
The inmate's name is Paul. He's serving 66 years for a drug-related murder. The department asked that we not use his last name out of consideration for his victim's family. Paul was put in segregation after a fight with another inmate.
How long have you been in?
I've been in here, this will be 17 days right now.
Paul wasn't allowed out of his cell, so I held my microphone against the closed door. I told him that I was reporting on prison suicide and that I wanted to know about the effects of isolation on inmates.
It changes you. It's like being on that side of the door looking at pictures in here doesn't really tell the picture until you've actually had this door shut on you and you've sat in here by yourself for long periods of time.
In recent years, the Washington Department of Corrections has reduced the use of segregation for inmates. This is part of a national trend based on research that shows the harmful effects of solitary confinement. Even so, hundreds of inmates a year end up in these isolated cells. But the department has a new policy that requires a mental health evaluation within one business day of an inmate being placed in segregation. They're now making sure those are done in private as well. Mental health staff are also now required to conduct rounds in segregation units at least once a week. These suicides did change policy. And people like Carrie Rayner and Dr. Bart are working to debunk myths that a lot of people, including prison staff, have about suicide. Like, if you ask someone about being suicidal, they're more likely to kill themselves. Here's Dr. Bart in suicide training class.
You're not going to Jedi mind trick plant something in their head that wasn't there before. You're not going to say, look at someone who you're concerned about and say, you know, are you thinking about committing suicide? And they're going to go, well, I wasn't until now. That's not going to happen.
Another myth is that someone who is intent on suicide can't be stopped. I heard that a lot in my interviews. One time, a prison official named Dan White made a comment along those lines while Carrie Rayner was listening in on a speakerphone.
I would say that if they are serious and they've done made their plan, they will figure out the best manner to conduct it.
Listen to how she responded.
But we
We also know from statistics there is almost always a point of intervention that we can take, and we want to be as alert to those potential points of intervention as we can.
In his report to Washington State, prison suicide expert Lindsay Hayes notes that two-thirds of suicide victims communicate their intent in some way. But the problem is these warning signs can easily be missed.
Suicide prevention is all about communicating and asking questions and making observations and getting to know an inmate enough to know when he's coming back from a phone call, how his body language is suggesting that it didn't go well.
If you read the Hayes report, you'll see that he has praise for Washington's prison system. He found the staff to be candid, cooperative, and he said genuinely concerned about inmate suicide. But there was one thing that alarmed him: how inmates who have been identified as suicidal are treated. He saw them stripped of their clothes and put in safety smocks, isolated without their belongings, and at Airway Heights, suicidal inmates were escorted in hand and leg restraints by two officers. Hayes called this overly restrictive and seemingly punitive, and he warned that inmates who think they're going to be punished won't acknowledge being suicidal. The Department of Corrections has since made a number of changes that are aimed at keeping suicidal inmates safe, but in the least restrictive environment possible. And Hayes says he's confident that Washington prisons are on a path to reduce the likelihood of future suicides. But he cautions that it will require ongoing vigilance to make sure complacency doesn't set in. Carrie Rayner says those were dark days back in 2014 and 2015, but today she's feeling good about where the department has come.
I wish that crisis had not occurred, and yet I don't know that we would have been sparked to really take a look at some of these factors had we not had that crisis.
All of the men who died by suicide had been convicted of a crime. Everyone in prison has been convicted of a crime. Many have victims. Many of the men who died had victims. And so I asked Carrie Rayner, why put this much effort into preventing inmate suicide?
I think it says something about our society when we take care of those people who are damaged, who've had difficult life experiences.
And she points out most people in prison are eventually released, and it's in society's best interest to make sure that when they get out, they're healthy, physically and mentally.
The prison population is a very disenfranchised population. These are people who are often shunned and experience a great deal of stigma in their lives. To be mentally ill and be in prison is exponentially stigmatizing, and yet these people need help. They deserve our help. And that's what we're here for.
After the last suicide in 2015, the Department of Corrections went 12 months without any inmates taking their own lives. The respite ended in September 2016. That's when a mentally ill inmate at the Monroe Prison hanged himself. In December, an inmate at Airway Heights hanged himself. The prison system says the goal is zero suicides. But two a year is pretty average.
You've been listening to Suicide Behind Bars, a presentation from KNKX and the Northwest News Network. Today's special was produced and reported by Austin Jenkins. Arwin Nix was the editor, and a special thanks to Phyllis Fletcher and the Northwest News Network. I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.